Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm Erica Weitz, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Off the air, I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. On the air, I get to bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by having these conversations with some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Monday at 1 o'clock on HeritageRadioNetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. On today's show, I'm joined by one of my personal icons, heroes, all of the above, Ruth Reichel. I can't imagine anyone listening to a show about women and food isn't familiar with her work, but just in case, I've prepared a very abbreviated resume, the sort of greatest hits. Ruth is a lifelong cook. She's authored a cookbook with the best title ever. She's authored four memoirs, one novel. She was the restaurant critic of both the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times. She's was the editor of the late, great Gourmet magazine, the recipient of six James Beard Awards, a Matrix Award. She's a mother. She's a wife. She's a prolific tweeter. Did I miss anything major?
I don't think so. I think you got it all.
Thank you so much for coming. We're already planning which pizza we're going to order at the break.
We're watching these people eat these pizzas out the window. It looks so delicious.
It's the 1 o'clock hour is hard because it's like you kind of like want to eat before, but then it's sort of you might want to wait after. So we'll do it right in the middle. I wanted to start today by talking about some logistics because anytime personally I have the opportunity to talk to someone whose career I admire, but also someone I just as a person admire, just the way you approach your life and carry yourself through it. My question is always, what's the day-to-day life of this person? Because I think the 24 hours we all have every day is a tremendous equalizer. So my first question is, what does a typical day look like for you? Is there such a thing?
I don't have a typical day anymore. I mean, it's really different not having a day job.
Yeah.
And, as a mom, you spend so much time organized. I mean, even though my son is 25, I still sort of feel the, oh, I can do whatever I want whenever I want to do it, which is, odd when you spend, the first 20 years of your kid's life sort of organizing it around your kid's schedule. And now I'm traveling a lot. So in the last 6 weeks, I've been in Australia, New Zealand, Portland, Oregon, Los Angeles,
amazing.
San Francisco,
I noticed
France.
I read your blog post about what you pack when you go on all your trips, and I noticed you brought your lightweight
jacket. I could not live without this Uniqlo little puffer. It goes everywhere, weighs nothing, keeps you warm.
I was so proud when I read that because I own one and I bought it when I was traveling on a shoot a long time ago for a TV show I was like helping to work on as an assistant. And I bought one. I've had it for years. And then when I read that you swear by the same thing, I felt so reaffirmed in my own packing choice.
Well, I have to say, if you travel a lot, there's nothing stupider than spending a lot of time waiting for your luggage to come off the plane. So unless I'm going on a really long trip, I carry on.
Yeah.
And that means packing really a lot of black pants, a couple of pairs of black pants, a lot of tops, a jacket. Boom, I'm done.
Do you have any, so nowadays that you don't have sort of a typical day-to-day life the way you did maybe when your son was younger, or you had a day job, are there any routines that you hold that you do every day?
Well, the big routine is getting up and cooking breakfast for my husband, who breakfast is his major meal. Dinner is my major meal. But so I get up in the morning and I make fresh juice for Michael. And, we start the day by saying, what do you want for breakfast? And I love starting the day, trying to think about cooking creatively, and then, you know, I think about what I'm going to tweet, and I sort of try, I really try gearing breakfast to the season. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I'm very big on leftovers too, you know, using leftovers in interesting ways. So
it's my favorite recreational activity is repurposing leftovers. So you make this breakfast for him, but you aren't necessarily eating all of it. You sort of,
This is a hard thing to admit, but, you know, not getting fat is one of the things that it takes up a lot of energy in my life. And I'm someone who loves sitting down to a long, leisurely meal. And I don't care. I mean, I don't get up hungry. Mm. I just don't. And cooking this big breakfast for Michael satisfies all of my sort of food needs for the morning moments. And I try and save my calories for later in the day.
I feel like that article you wrote for Allure, sort of on that subject of kind of maintaining your weight during this career of consumption, essentially. I remember talking to you about it afterwards, and you were saying, you know, if we could, you know, use our time that we spend not eating or thinking about that more effectively, like think about how much we would get done.
Well, it's really hard to be a food person and be a woman who, I mean, not only are you yourself affected by your body image, but I think the world is, I mean, men have a different way of being in the world. You know, big men are Falstaffian. Mm-hmm. I mean, they get a pass. Mm-hmm. Big women don't. And as someone who was a fat teenager and was miserable about it, I just don't want to be fat again. That's a hard admission. No, you know, I wish I didn't care.
I think it's, I mean, we talk a lot, I feel like people in general, and then on this show, I've tried to talk a lot about women in food, and it's a thing that doesn't come up that much, but I think I think every woman has some body image moment of some sort, and especially when your passion is food, you work in food, it's bound to affect you in some way or another.
And when you're a restaurant critic, where, I mean, literally your job depends on ingesting as much food as you possibly can.
Every single dish on every single menu, for sure. I feel like you spoke in that article so well about kind of being really in touch with yourself and identifying, you know, what you're hungry for. And so for you, if that's maybe preparing this meal for your husband in the morning and that fulfills some desire in you to cook and share and all that, but you're not necessarily physically hungry at that moment, you're waiting until later. It's, you know, it sounds to me like being really self-aware, which.
And I think hunger is something that we use food for things that don't have much to do with real hunger. And I think it's, you know, if you're going to be in food, you really have to learn, you have to study your own appetites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all the emotions behind it.
Yeah.
Speaking of sort of food beyond food, I think I want to talk a little bit about storytelling. I love that your author's note in, I think it was Tender at the Bone, said that you mentioned that you learned early that the most important thing in life is a good story. And so much of your work can be categorized, I think, as storytelling, all these different hats you've worn. You know, whether at Gourmet or as a critic, I think you've produced amazing stories and have told them. Your restaurant reviews read like wonderful descriptive short stories. Does good storytelling continue to be the guiding principle in your work in life?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would say storytelling is sort of not just in my work, but in daily life. Mm. I mean, being able to tell a story. And, you know, I talk a lot about the importance of the family table, and it goes way beyond food. I mean, I think, you know, my mother, I've written about this ad nauseum, that my mother was the world's worst cook, but but we did sit down to dinner, mm-hmm. Every night in my house. And I felt like I learned to be a writer at the dinner table, because when you sat down with my family, you were supposed to be able to tell a story of what happened to you during the day. And what I learned just growing up, listening to my father telling a story about what happened to him on the bus, or, you know, something that happened at the office, and my mother talking about something that happened to her at the grocery store or somewhere. And I learned to edit a story to find, you know, what are you going to tell? How are you going to make it most interesting? And I think that's how I learned to be a writer.
How interesting.
That, you know, it was sitting at the table, listening to them, getting my story ready in my head. And that's very much how I write, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, like every restaurant review, I would have the bare bones of, okay, this was the food. And then mostly it would come to me in the shower. I would be in the shower and I'd be thinking, how am I going to tell this? Yeah. What's the approach? What's my lead? And then it's just a matter of like putting it, I mean, that's the hard work of writing is organizing it in your head. And then you're just putting it down on mm-hmm. the page.
Yeah. So the shower to you is the space where...
It does happen kind of inadvertently, you know. I mean, you're in there and, you know, part of being in the shower is the noise is really yeah. in your own head.
Yeah.
You know, there's not much else happening.
So no singing for you.
You would not want to hear me sing, believe me.
So funny. I think that's so interesting that you grew up with storytelling as this daily practice and almost this expectation from your family that you would, you know, be able to show up along with everyone else to do that. And it sounds like it's kind of what you do when you were talking earlier about cooking breakfast for your husband and then how you tweet it afterwards. I mean, you immediately tell this very abbreviated
Yeah, this is the story of our morning.
That's so funny. That's great. Is there any, do you have a favorite storyteller?
You know, so many. Yeah. I mean, at the moment, I am completely enthralled with George Saunders. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think 10th of December is just the most extraordinary piece of writing. You know, you hear these voices completely. You picture these people. And he has such a dystopian view, and yet he's so kind. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such an odd thing that he's pretty pessimistic about where the world is going. Mm-hmm. And yet he's so humane with his characters. He's fantastic. I love Hilary Mantel. I mean, she's just, Bring Up the Bodies and Wolf Hall are such fantastic books.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, I mean, fiction for me is just a complete addiction. So I tend to, I mean, the book I just finished, Americana, Chimamanda mm-hmm. Adichie's book is
beautiful.
It's yeah. such a beautiful piece of storytelling.
Yeah. Do you feel like you read as much as you write, or you read more than you write?
Oh, I read more than yeah. I write. Yeah. I mean, reading is pure pleasure. Mm-hmm. Writing is really hard.
It's the hard work. I feel like there's that old sort of saying about, like, you know, real writers like hate what they do so much, but you can't sort of. You know, how does it, like, you can't live without writing. But.
Well, I hate writing, but I love having written.
Yeah.
And so that's the addiction, mm-hmm. right? You know, that drug that you want, that feeling mm-hmm. that nothing feels like that day when you've turned it in. Yeah.
It's a good feeling.
Yeah.
I've got a deadline on the horizon, so I'm fantasizing about that. I recently listened to the Taste Matters show you recorded for Heritage with Mitchell Davis from the James Beard Foundation. And I was so struck by what you said about always choosing the hardest thing to do. And you were talking about that you've always jumped into situations where you might not have always had, you know, huge amounts of experience. When you started first reviewing restaurants, when you were named editor of Gourmet. And I think that show you were particularly talking about, Delicious, right. which was your first work of fiction. Is that approach of sort of jumping in, you know, just right into the deep end, is that something you've consciously embraced, or is that more of a pattern in your life that you've noticed?
No, it's something I've consciously mm-hmm. embraced. I mean, it might have been when my parents sent me off to this French boarding school, mm-hmm. and which was the most miserable thing that ever happened to me. You know, I was... this is the middle of the year. I didn't speak a word of French. I'm suddenly abandoned in this alien place where nobody speaks any English. I don't speak any French. And it was horrible.
And you were young.
I
mean, you were,
yeah, I was. Yeah. I just turned 13, like 2 days earlier. And I've never been more miserable. I mean, I, you know, begged them to let me come home. I cried. But looking back, it was a really valuable experience. And I think it was a lesson to me that the hard things are the things that you should go for, that there's something about, you know, knowing that you can fail and then overcoming it, that
it's very powerful.
Is very powerful, that gives you real faith in yourself, and that faith in yourself is probably the most valuable thing you can have as a person.
Absolutely. And,
you know, I just kept learning that lesson over and over again, that the things that, I mean, certainly as an editor at Gourmet, I learned the stories that I had nightmares about when I knew I was going to be fired for running these stories were exactly the ones that I had to do.
Are there any that come to mind?
Well, yeah, there are a couple. I mean, the first one was like actually in the first issue, the second issue. Michael Ruhlman did a piece about Thomas Keller, and he does this very graphic description of Keller asks his rabbit purveyor to bring him live rabbits. And then he tries to kill these rabbits, and he doesn't know how to do it, and he's very clumsy. And at a certain point, he breaks the rabbit's leg. Oh, and he says, rabbits scream like humans, and this one screamed really loud. And it's this, I mean, you have to understand, this is like 1999. This is not now. This is a time when people are very squeamish. And my publisher looked at this and said, you can't run this. I mean, this is like, I had just taken over the magazine, this very proper magazine. And she said, you can't run this. I mean, you're going to get, you know, thousands of people are going to say, cancel my subscription. And I said, no, this is really important to this story. Because the moral of it is, he learns in this that he says, this is life itself. I've just learned that food is life itself, and that these had to be the best rabbits that anybody ever made, that I could not waste these precious lives. And that's a really important thing to say. And, you know, and I knew that I had to do it. And there was that story. And then, of course, there was the David Foster Wallace piece, Consider the Lobster, which, you know, everybody was horrified that we were going to run this piece.
Sort of similar vein.
No pun intended.
Terrible. No, I think when you've had the courage to run stories that matter, even if they're not the most conventional choice, or to support writers, you know, as they work on that, that's a powerful decision and a courageous one.
And we ran a bunch of investigative stuff that also really frightened me. You know, the tomato slaves piece, you know, these pieces where the lawyers are sort of tearing out their hair and going, I don't know. An amazing piece about how Procter & Gamble had known for 30 years about the problems with trans fats and had a task force to make sure that that news never got
out. Didn't come out. Yeah. Well, good for you.
Those are scary pieces. Yeah. But, you know, it was like that's what you should do if you have that pulpit.
Yeah.
You've got to use it.
I'm so glad that that was your approach. And as someone who read Gourmet while you edited it, I mean, it has a big impact to be able to read those things, and the world gets bigger and more meaningful. And I think it makes you aware of your decisions as a consumer and as a cook and all of the above. Were you ever offered, I was thinking about all these opportunities that you've said yes to that, you know, have scared you. Were you ever offered an opportunity that scared you, that you regret not taking?
No, I don't think, yeah. I mean, it's like one of the things that my husband keeps saying to me, you have to learn to say no.
The no scares me.
I tend to say yes to, you know, Michael will say too much, but
that's so funny. It would be good to get his answers to these questions. What's your advice to young people, especially women, who want to break into any kind of field that scares them, whether it be writing or cooking or something else altogether?
Well, you know, I gave the keynote address at this Women in Wine event this morning, and It was all about giving people advice. And, you know, I think the biggest piece of advice I have is, you know, we're really privileged in the first world to be able to make choices. Most of the women in the world can't make those choices. And as someone who can, I think you really have an obligation to not waste 1 minute of your life doing things that you don't like to do. And, you know, work hard, love your work, and if you don't love your work, find something that you do love. I mean, I think it's really important to follow your passion. And, you know, making a lot of money is nice, but, you know, at the end of your life, what do you have except a pile of money?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's great advice.
And the other thing is, you know, I think it's really important to recognize that, you know, for most of human history, women were not allowed to do interesting work. And, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of the couple generations before us who created these opportunities for us to be working women. And it is difficult. I mean, balancing your work life and your personal life is really hard. It's much hard. I mean, nobody begrudges men the time that they spend at work. Everybody has issues with women. They want to guilt trip you about it. Don't let that happen. That guilt is an indulgence, and bat it away. You know, it's you deserve to have meaningful work.
That's great advice.
And your children will be better for it. I mean, your children will be better with happy, fulfilled mothers than they will with hovering mothers who spend all their time worrying if their kids are happy.
I can speak firsthand to that. And I grew up with a mother who worked constantly. And I mean, when I'm asked that question, being on the other, I feel like a lot of people ask mothers what their experience is. But as a daughter of a working mother, I think, I mean, I also didn't know it any other way, so I can't really say. It's just my life. But I think it's the most wonderful thing in the world. And to see a woman fulfilled by both her career and her personal life was a very powerful world to grow up in. And I think has informed the way I've made every decision in my life.
I had the opposite. I mean, I had a woman who wanted to be able to work. And I remember, like, putting my key in the door, you know, like being like 9 years old, 10 years old, putting my key in the door and praying my mother wouldn't be there. You know, wishing she would be out doing something and watching the difference between my father, who loved his work, and my mother, who was just kind of beating her head against the wall, wanting meaningful work, not having it, and looking at her and thinking, I will not be like you. I will go out and work. I will not drive my children crazy.
Too funny. All so wonderful. We're going to take a really quick break. We'll probably order a pizza, and we'll come back and talk a little bit more about some new things.
Great.
Come on.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Severa Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julie Tersh, and I'm back with Ruth Reichel. We've put in our pizza order, so all is well. Just before the break, we were talking about sort of taking risks, leaping off the cliff, so to speak, when it comes to work and life and embracing choices that really give you a meaningful life. And I think Ruth is a living, breathing example of the benefits of doing all that. I wanted to talk a little bit now about sort of some things you've noticed. And I really like what you said when it comes to restaurant criticism, what you said to your friend Evan Kleiman in the interview that appears in the third issue of Cherry Bomb, the issue whose cover you grace. You said that the biggest difference in the dance between reviewer and eater these days is the eater, that the young people with disposable income who tend to be well-traveled and well-fed are the ones that really hold the power. What do you think is the role of restaurant criticism these days? And, I mean, do you think it still has a place?
I think it definitely has a place, but it's a very different place than it had, you know, even 15 years mm-hmm. ago. You know, now, I mean, I think it's a great thing because, I mean, for the longest time, restaurant critics thought they should be consumer reporters, that they should basically be telling people how to spend their money. One of my own goals as a critic was to try and get beyond that, mm-hmm. to say, you know, I want to do something that is less consumer reporting and more like real criticism. And what real criticism, and that's whether it's, you know, a book review, a movie review, an art critique, a theater review, I think should leave the person who's reading it better prepared to experience whatever it is that they're about to, whatever piece of culture they're going to ingest. And, you know, so you should go to the theater and see things you wouldn't see if you hadn't read that review. Sure. And appreciate it in new ways. And I think that restaurant criticism should do the same thing, should give you context, should describe if it's an unfamiliar cuisine, talk about what that cuisine is, you know, what is Malaysian food. It can put that food in context. It can put you in the seat and actually give you the experience of tasting the food. And what social media has done is essentially remove the need for consumer criticism because it's out there. I mean, you want to know, you know, what 400 people thought about Roberta's restaurant, it's there on Yelp, it's there on TripAdvisor, it's all over the place. And so you need the people who are being paid to do restaurant criticism to take it a step further. And they have to be smarter than they've ever been before. They have to be better writers than they've ever been before. There's certainly a place for restaurant criticism, but it's a very different place and certainly different than it was in Craig Claiborne's day.
Absolutely, yeah. A lot more cooks in the kitchen.
Yes.
Knowing which one.
And of course, I mean, the other thing is that the diners are just so much more knowledgeable. I mean, you know, when I was writing restaurant reviews, I just had to be like, you know, half a step ahead of everybody else. You know, when I wanted to learn about Thai food, I went to Thailand and none of my readers had been there. Now, you know, half the people who are reading this have probably, you know, gone and eaten real Thai
sure.
food.
Yeah. I think which all makes it for a really exciting restaurant atmosphere and place to cook and eat and all of the above, but definitely maybe a harder place to navigate.
Yeah.
I'm curious, where, how do you decide where to eat these days? Are there anyone's reviews that you follow, or do you listen to friend recommendations? Do you go back to places most of the time? Or
I listen to friends. I'm curious about what's new. So, you know, I do tend to sort of stop, you know, I mean, I who have keep deploring the fact that, you know, everybody's going out to taste the new. And now I find myself as an ordinary consumer going out to taste the new, just because I'm really curious about where it's going. And of course I have, you know, places that I just go to again and again. I think one of the great joys of restaurant going is being a regular and being able to go to a restaurant and they know when you walk in the door what you're going to eat.
Yeah. I think that's the embodiment of what it feels like to be just recognized as a person, is that feeling of walking into a restaurant where they know you.
Right.
Yeah. Are there any standbys you want to mention, or you keep those to yourself?
No, I mean, I think probably my biggest standby in New York is Pearl Oyster Bar. Mm-hmm. I mean, I agree. It is the single most consistent restaurant I think I've ever been to.
I had Rebecca Charles on the show a few weeks ago, and I said that it has always been and continues to be my favorite restaurant in New York. And then about a week after that, my mom, who very sweetly listens to the show every week, I was at the Cher cancer benefit, and Rebecca was cooking there, and my mom pulled her aside and whispered to her and said she was telling the truth. She really means it. So that's the full circle of Pearl. Could not recommend it highly enough. I think it's the most consistent place ever.
Yeah. And they know exactly, you know.
Your order?
I go with my family. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I know what everybody's order is. You know? my order is, I love steamers. I love clams. I mean, I will eat clams in any possible way. So I usually have clams on a half shell and steamers and a boiled lobster with fries instead of the corn pudding, and then we share a Caesar salad.
Perfect.
And I mean, of course, if Nick's there, then
happy
he probably,
as a clam.
I'm happy as a clam. That's true.
I couldn't resist. And if Nick is there?
If Nick is there, he'll want the butterscotch sundae, which is also really good.
Yeah. Good to share.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
I wanted to spend just the rest of the show talking about something that you touched on when we spoke together at the Cherry Bomb Jubilee, sort of the history of women in the food industry and the forecast, so to speak. And you mentioned that in terms of evaluating the gender disparity that we've all spoken so much and seen in the food industry, you recognize something I think is so important, which is to pay attention not only to how many women hold executive chef positions, but also other positions that offer more balance in terms of your job and your life and how women have chosen those positions and continue to champion them. I was just wondering if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a mistake because we all keep lamenting the fact that there's not a woman who's a Wolfgang Puck, a Danielle, Jean-Georges. And there are a few reasons for it. And one is that these people are all funded by men, and we need to find an angel who will fund a woman. But beyond that, I think that women look for something different in their work life than men do. And they don't need the glory. And they're also often people who need to support their families. And I noticed it when I was looking at a union shop. And I looked in the kitchen and realized that it was mostly women. And I suddenly thought, are women choosing jobs that have, instead of the possibility of becoming rich and famous, that offer security, health benefits, reasonable hours? And I think if you look at women in the food industry, you will find that, in fact, there is a kind of parity, that it's just that women have deliberately chosen not to be the big macho bull who needs to be, you know, the billionaire famous person, but, in fact, somebody who has a job that they like that offers them, you know, real security. It's a very different way of being in the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, one of the things that we all know happens is that, you know, many women who, you know, start out being, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20, wanting to go into the food industry in their mid-30s, suddenly look around and go, wait a minute, if I want to have children, this is no life. Because, you know, being a restaurant chef, working a split shift, I mean, the hours are punishing. You need a wife. And women at that age often opt to do something different, to go into pastry, which has different hours, to go be personal chefs, to cater, to go work in test kitchens. I mean, you see it over and over again that women who love this industry and love this business choose to do other kinds of work.
And what about, I think there's sort of another part of the kind of wheel in all this, which is how, you know, which jobs we choose in the media to sort of celebrate and give attention to. Because I think this feeling of maybe this disparity could also come from the fact that more men are being talked about. It doesn't mean that only men are doing the work. So what do you think the role is for, you know, for people who are writing about, talking about food?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that we have a lot to answer for, those of us who do write about food. I mean, I think not paying enough attention to women, like being too taken with the celebrity aspect. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are a celebrity-driven culture, but I think that we in the media need to be better than that. And I certainly think, you know, not just the issue of women, but I'm now, you know, I'm doing work with the Rural and Migrant Ministry, which is, they're an amazing group of people who are working for farm worker justice. And I think we have not in the media done nearly enough to talk about justice for food workers, mm-hmm. which is, you know,
hugely important.
Hugely yeah. important. And in all aspects of the food business, there are people who are being terribly exploited.
Well, I'm so glad that the way that you described the work that you did at Gourmet and championed, and just that ability to, you know, say yes to a story that might not be the easiest story to put out in the world. Sounds like you're continuing to do that in a way that's really important and inspiring lots of other people to do that. So thank you.
You know, I feel like, you know, I've been so lucky in my career, and it is, you know, time for me to try and pass it on.
Terrific. Well, Ruth, I'm not sure if you would enjoy, but I would be happy to ask you questions all day. Sadly, we're just about out of time, and I wanted to leave a few minutes for the very fun, lighthearted Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A. The 7 questions I ask everyone who comes on. No pressure, no wrong answers. So we will begin. Number 1, sweet or salty?
Oh, salty.
Salty. Number 2, what did you have for breakfast today?
Oh, I didn't eat breakfast today.
Did you tweet about it? I didn't look.
I did. No, I didn't. I mean, I got up and went and gave this talk this morning very early, and I have not eaten one morsel of food today.
So we're about to remedy that. Number 3, if I were to look into your refrigerator at home right now, what might I be surprised to find?
Oh, there would be many things that would surprise you, but probably the thing that would surprise you most is a length of yamaimo, the Japanese mountain potato, which I absolutely love. You know, the thing that when you grate mm-hmm. goes down into pure yeah. slime. And this wonderful substance called hozon, which they're making, which I asked them if I could taste it, which is so delicious.
And how do you use it?
Well, one of the things I do is use it on yummy. It's something you use in place of miso, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to figure out how to use it.
Cool. It's a good ingredient. Number 4, what's your go-to snack?
Bread and butter. Or matzahs and butter. I mean, a matzah with butter is one of the most delicious things on earth.
Salted butter, unsalted?
Oh, no. I like cold, sweet, cultured butter.
Mm-hmm. And salted matzah?
Unsalted. Just plain matzah.
Yeah. What's your favorite time of day?
Oh, I don't know that I have one. I mean, I love morning. It's so optimistic. I love, I also love that time at 7 o'clock or so, and I'm moving into the kitchen and opening a bottle of wine and having a first glass of wine.
That's a good time, opening your hose on. number six, where would you love to travel to next? Or where are you traveling to next, in your case?
Where am I traveling to? Oh, I'm going to Iceland.
Oh, wow.
The Iceland Writers Retreat.
Sounds very cool.
Which I've never been to and I'm excited
about.
That'll
be great. Yeah. And number seven, my last question, which I think I'm so curious what your answer is, knowing how much you've written about your mother. What was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Oh, my mother did not mm-hmm. cook much well, but there were a couple of things she really could do, and one was corn. And my mother had this farmer down the road, and she would put a pot of water on to boil, and then she would call him and say, go out and pick the youngest, whitest ears of corn you can get. And she would come home, and we would have lobster and corn that was just minutes out of the ground, and a baked potato, and that was
perfect.
Heaven to me.
That sounds great. Ruth, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It means so much to me and to Heritage and to Cherry Bomb. Everything about you, including regularly updated blog posts, which I so look forward to, about your meals and everything, it's all available at ruthreichel.com. And your Twitter handle is the same. It's just your name. No
yes.
punctuation, right?
No punctuation.
Okay.
No.
Thank you so much.
This has been really fun. Thanks.
It's been great. And as always, thank you to everyone for listening. Tune in next Monday at 1 o'clock for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store, by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.